Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Brazil's COVID-19 ordeal is deeply concerning, the UN Health Agency said on Friday in an appeal for greater vigilance and new measures to prevent transmission of the virus. Dr. Margaret Harris from the World Health Organization, WHO, told journalists in Geneva that the Latin American country needed more government support urgently.
Brazil has been suffering terrible losses, but the message is, again, the public health social measures work. You have to apply them. Now, it is very difficult for people who are living in crowded conditions, so they need the support. They need the support at every level to be able to avoid the crowding, avoid the close contact to everyone who is potentially infected, needs to be identified so that they can be removed from the healthy.
The WHO spokesperson also called for much greater testing for infection before repeating the agency's call to follow the example of countries that had rolled out national vaccination programs, averting large numbers of deaths. To date, Brazil has seen the second highest death toll from the coronavirus after the United States, more than 340,000 deaths. Latest vaccine data from the WHO shows that the country has dispensed nearly 20 million doses. But the world faces a serious shortfall of vaccines, which has left many countries waiting to begin their inoculation campaigns, Dr. Harris said. To the Middle East now, and ongoing concerns from the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, over Jordan's Prince Hamza and Dubai's Princess Latifah. OHCHR discussed the cases, which are not connected, during a press conference in Geneva on Friday. Spokesperson Mata Hurtado explained that Prince Hamza, former Crown Prince of Jordan, had been arrested and detained earlier this month, along with at least 16 senior officials and tribal leaders.
We are aware that there is an ongoing investigation, but still it's not clear to us if following the mediation on 5th of April, Prince Hamza is still under de facto house arrest or not.
Ms. Hurtado said that the arrests were the latest in an escalating series of measures targeting criticism of government policy and corruption, contributing to an increasingly repressive segregation of society. Regarding Princess Latifah, the daughter of Dubai's Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, who reportedly tried to flee the emirate in 2018, the OHCHR official said that so far, requests to her family for proof of life had not been answered. Private discussions with the mission of the United Arab Emirates to the UN in Geneva had been established, Ms. Hurtado said, adding that the Rights Office was seeking clear, compelling evidence about the princess's well-being. To Denmark, finally, where the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has urged the authorities not to return displaced Syrians to the war-shattered country against their will. The appeal follows reports that the Danish authorities are reassessing the protection needs of some Syrian refugees on the grounds that the situation in their home region has improved. Agency spokesperson Babar Balok told journalists in Geneva that the development was a concern, as UNHCR did not believe that recent security improvements in parts of Syria were sufficiently fundamental, stable or durable to justify ending international protection for any group of refugees. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello, in this week's UN Catch-Up, we're checking in with the World Health Organization for the latest key COVID-19 developments, including an equitable vaccine distribution milestone. Also, we'll hear from the UN Refugee Agency and an alert about increasingly vulnerable Afghan refugees who need life-saving medical care. And before our 15-minute studio time is up, we'll be finding out how the latest gadget and robot tech can help more of us every day, thanks to the World Intellectual Property Organization. And we'll have closing comments from regular guest Solange Beltege-Cortez. Thanks for listening. First, the news. More than 100 countries and economies have now received COVID-19 vaccines through the UN-partnered Equitable Coronavirus Busting Scheme, COVAX. The first delivery of life-saving jabs arrived in Ghana on the 24th of February. Announcing the news on Thursday, the UN World Health Organization, WHO, said that more than 38 million doses of AstraZeneca, Pfizer-BioNTech, and Serum Institute of India have been transported globally so far. The aim is to deliver at least 2 billion doses of vaccines in 2021, in particular to developing countries. The development comes as WHO and other health regulators reaffirmed the overwhelming value of the AstraZeneca, or AZ, COVID-19 vaccine amid ongoing concerns about clotting events among a very small number who've had the jab. In statements on Wednesday evening, the WHO's Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety, the European Medicines Agency, and the UK's regulator all concluded that the benefits of taking the AZ vaccine outweigh the very rare potential risks. More than 190 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine have been administered to date, but only 182 cases of clotting have been reported, WHO said, as it advised countries to continue to vaccinate with the AZ vaccine, noting that it had saved millions of lives and prevented serious illness. To the issue of COVID-19 vaccination passports now, which the UN Health Agency has yet to support, after saying that inoculation against coronavirus may not prevent transmission. In response to journalists' questions on Tuesday, the World Health Organization said that the passports may not be an effective strategy for restarting global travel. Here's spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris.
We would not like to see vaccination as a, or the vaccination passport as a requirement for entry or exit, because we're not certain that at this stage that the vaccine prevents transmission, and there are all those other questions, apart from the question of discrimination against people who are not able to have the vaccine for one reason or another.
There have been more than 132 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, including more than 2.86 million deaths globally. Only around 650 million vaccine doses have been administered so far. To Iran, where the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has appealed for funding to help hundreds of thousands of foreign nationals receive basic health care. Some 800,000, mainly Afghan nationals, live in Iran. The country provides free COVID-19 treatment and hospital care, but premiums for surgery and other life-saving help are increasingly beyond the reach of many. UNHCR spokesperson Babar Balok told journalists in Geneva on Tuesday that this increases the likelihood that refugees will not seek treatment for urgent health needs, or they might send their children to work, making them even more vulnerable.
The impact of the pandemic on livelihoods has been particularly severe for refugees who usually rely on precarious and unstable jobs. Many can no longer cover their most basic needs, let alone the costs of the health insurance, which is estimated to represent some 40% of an average refugee family's monthly expenditure.
UNHCR already helps 100,000 refugees get healthcare in Iran, and it has just secured funding to ensure that another 20,000 can access the country's national health insurance scheme. But the agency noted that its 2021 funding appeal of $97 million is only 7% funded. The news there, and this is UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. Now, before this week's interview, imagine you had a relative with dementia who you worried wasn't eating enough. You're too far away to check in on them every day, so what do you do? Well, one solution is to install a smart fridge in their home. That's to say, one that tells you when it was used and who took what. I'll tell you what I could have done with one of those at college, come to think of it. Joking aside, to find out more about these assistive technologies and how they're already helping people with failing sight, hearing or balance, I spoke to technology innovation expert Irene Kitsara from the UN World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO.
So assistive technologies covers a very wide range of products, which may be from assistive clothing, which will help them dress and undress to go to their work or go to their school, up to products which will help them communicate with others or participate in every aspect of life, do sports, just to name a few. So the advantage of assistive technology is to help them, to support them despite these functional limitations, to do what everyone else considers their daily routine.
And you look at all of the patents that come in every year and you've seen that there's been this double-digit growth in the sector. So you know that change is coming, but is it coming soon?
So we have a lot of technologies which thankfully will become more available soon thanks to general interest of consumer electronic goods. So some of these technologies have crossover or spillover effect on consumer electronic goods. So because of this more increased interest, we expect that kind of technologies and that kind of products to become more readily available. We're talking about products that refer to gaming industry, so the gamers, a great motivation for brain-computer interfaces that would help us control our mobile phones or our computers, make it sooner to the market. Similarly, we have all kinds of consumer electronic goods that are linked to our smart homes or smart cities. And so, for instance, visually impaired person can do their shopping in a mall and get a navigation, benefiting from advancements, sensors, and general enabling technologies. So advancements in that, thanks to smart assistants and navigation aids, can have a particular benefit for persons who cannot see or they cannot move. And they can, thanks to this general interest, they can make it sooner to the market.
And what's been the sort of breakthrough? Is it having a mobile phone, a smartphone?
Absolutely. I think the broader availability of smartphones can assist availability of smartphone apps, which are very easy to access, more inexpensive. And in some cases, they replace some specialized assistive material that would be otherwise required, or hardware. We have a lot of these speech input technologies that replace a lot of specialized and expensive materials. And also the advancements we have had recently in areas like artificial intelligence, we have better sensors. All these very recent advancements, which revolutionized a number of areas, can benefit the area of assistive technology and, as a result, all of us. So we can find more applications and we can find increasingly software-based applications, which are also more inexpensive and, as a result, can reach out more audience.
So you're saying that these devices might become cheaper and more accessible? I mean, assuming that you have a mobile phone in the first place.
Yes, this is the expectation also of other UN agencies, including the World Health Organization. So they expect that we will have what they call a market shaping. That means that there will be more potential end customers who can benefit from this kind of applications. And as a result, this will drop the prices.
And how many people are you expecting to be able to use them? I think it's, what, 1 billion people now benefit from assistive technologies. How many by, say, 2030?
So the expectations of the World Health Organization is that this number will double. And these are people who need to access just the assistive technology, people with functional limitations. We should add to that all these potential users, everyone else who can benefit from that. So, for instance, people who would otherwise, let's say, not use a hearing aid because they are not yet there, but who could benefit from other products which could help them if they're not hearing that well.
Let's just run through quickly some of the inventions. I mean, it's fascinating. You've got smart mirrors. You've got feeder robots. There was also another invention where it monitored the state of mind of those with depression to perhaps flag a warning sign when they may be feeling very blue.
Yes, this has a particular importance for elderly people or people who suffer from cognitive decline, because thanks to these devices which monitor if, say, somebody has been not feeling very well, and a smart mirror is just an application of that. A smart refrigerator can also track if people are eating or not, which may be also a sign of depression. A smart bathroom can also check if everyone is following their hygiene, or they can track with face recognition whether how they are feeling.
And Irene Kitsara from WIPO, which is the UN Patent Expert Office, maybe you could tell me how smart your house is. I mean, do you have these smart devices at home? Do you feel that your life needs these assistive technologies?
I think that they are more integrated than I would have thought before this report. So for sure, I have all these smart TVs that make me recommendations on what I may like to see. I have a vacuum cleaner, which is smart and will detect when it is needed to do householding exercise. So I would say there are a lot of these devices that are already there of general use that can benefit everyone. And I'm one of the beneficiaries, for sure.
Many thanks to Irene Kitsara there from the UN World Intellectual Property Organization for explaining how assistive tech is likely to help 2 billion people by 2030. For more information, search online for WIPO's latest report on this. It's called Technology Trends. Now, before we wrap up the show, let's hear from our regular guest, Solange Berhotegui-Cortez. Do you have any thoughts on these virtual aids, Solange? I have to say, I'm a big fan, because without my hearing aids, home and work life would be pretty rotten. But I look forward to the day, I have to say, when I can fiddle with them to tailor them to my needs without having to ask the technician to adjust them, which is a pretty long and tedious process. Over to you, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. Last night, I accidentally dropped my mobile into the toilet. I felt immediately lost, alone. I need my mobile. But do I miss it also? For a long time, a phone is no longer just a phone. Personally, I am not a fan of having assistive technology at home, but even without wanting to have it, I know that it is already there. At the United Nations, we have this mantra, leave no one behind. To me, it means making sure that people with disabilities, older generations, and those affected by chronic disease are included in society and enabled to live a healthy and dignified life. Before COVID-19, our world was already profoundly inequal. The past year, with the current pandemic, these inequalities have become more visible than ever, including access to assistive technology. According to the World Health Organization, today, only 1 in 10 people in need has access to assistive technology, owing to high costs and a lack of awareness, availability, trained person, and financing. And let's not forget that we are far from equity in terms of basic services, access to electricity, water, roads, and of course, the internet. Don't forget that there are other primary needs that must be solved if assistive technologies are to fulfill their role. For the UN Health Agency, WHO, addressing the unmet need of assistive products is crucial to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, to provide universal health coverage, and to implement the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which has been ratified by 177 countries. The challenge is, as Irene Kitsara said, to democratize the access of these technologies, and don't assume that we have already equality. The road ahead is still long, and yet change is coming, and one of these days, maybe, I will have a smart mirror at home, a magic mirror on the wall.
A magic mirror on the wall. Be careful what you wish for. We all know what happened to Narcissus. Thank you, Solange, for that. I think we are pretty much done here. It's been fascinating to talk about how technology can help us, its pitfalls as well, and I think more importantly and more realistically, the fact that it is not available to really the many millions of people who need it, only those with the sufficient means, like us perhaps, living in wealthy countries. So thank you again for that thought-provoking response, Solange. And thank you too to our production assistant, Justine Bryce, listening in the wings, and she'll be putting this podcast online very shortly. Thanks to you too, listeners. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to catching up with you again next week. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye for now.
Stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression.
It's breathtaking. You know, for folks that are listening to this, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you then. Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network, your monthly podcast that's all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can subscribe by emailing me at naomi@taxjustice.net. Give me an email, say hello, or just find us on your favourite podcast app. Give us some 5-star ratings. Coming up later, economists in the dock.
These people are advancing ideas not based in fact. So what we're seeing are lost opportunities.
I'll be speaking to finance journalist and writer Tom Bergin on how economics ruins the economy. Let's head straight over now to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network to discuss this month's developments. Okay, John, so this month the Tax Justice Network published its 2021 results for the Corporate Tax Haven Index. So every 2 years our researchers assess and rank the countries which are the worst offenders in helping multinational corporations pay less tax than they should. The top 10 that we have this time round are the British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, all British overseas territories. Number 4, the Netherlands. Number 5, Switzerland. Number 6, Luxembourg. Number 7, Hong Kong. Number 8, Jersey, which is a British Crown dependency. Number 9, Singapore. And at number 10, it's the United Arab Emirates. TaxCast listeners can read up on the Corporate Tax Haven Index on www.corporatetaxhavenindex.com. As usual, as you'll have heard, the British Overseas Territories and Crown Dependencies feature heavily. The UK itself on its own is at number 13. And as with all our indexes, the Financial Secrecy Index as well, so many of the global offenders are OECD countries. What would you highlight as being some of the most important stories from these latest results?
Well, I think the most important story told by this Corporate Tax Haven Index is how the most powerful countries in the world, that is the countries represented by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, have shaped the rules for a global tax regime which totally ignores the interests of all other countries. And that the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries have created between them this globalized economy in which tax havens, almost all of which are either OECD member states or dependencies and former colonies of OECD member states, these tax havens play a really central part in shifting wealth away from the country. Typically it's through illicit financial flows, and so this wealth is shifted away from where wealth is actually created into the hands of the owners of capital, who use tax havens to avoid paying tax.
Right, and OECD countries and their dependencies are responsible for 68% of the world's corporate tax abuse risks.
Well, yeah, if we take just the top 10 players of the Corporate Tax Haven Index, we can see 3 OECD member states, Luxembourg, Netherlands and Switzerland. We can see 4 dependent territories of the UK, which of course is another OECD member state, the British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, Cayman and Jersey, and 2 former colonies of the United Kingdom, Hong Kong and Singapore. So the OECD member states dominate the whole index. Now what this tells us is that the world of corporate tax havens is not some kind of unfortunate outcome of globalization. It is in fact a core part of the late 20th century model of globalization. So as far as I'm concerned, the big story that the Corporate Tax Haven Index tells relates to the power of the world's biggest economies to rig the rules in their own special interests and to block the rest of the world from reforming those rules in ways that would prevent powerful corporations from avoiding tax and from extracting wealth from the world's poorest countries.
So, I mean, it's obvious now, if it hasn't been obvious before, and TaxCasters know we've been saying this for such a long time, the OECD is obviously not the right organisation to be deciding on global tax rules.
We've long argued for the United Nations to be central in deciding global tax rules, with more countries having a say. As the famous expression goes, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And last month, in addition, the United Nations High-Level Panel on International Financial Accountability, Transparency and Integrity, FACTI, called for a UN tax convention, which would be an agreement adopted by the UN General Assembly that would create all kinds of international norms and standards which would become legally binding when UN member states ratify that convention. Let's talk a bit about that as a way forward.
Well, yeah, it is, I think, the only way forward now. It seems a no-brainer to me that if the world wants to see an end to the institutional stranglehold that the rich and powerful countries hold over the rulemaking process, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development really needs to relinquish its rule-setting role and hand over to a genuinely global and accountable body. Now, in the best of all worlds, I think we'd see the creation of a world tax authority mandated by the United Nations to set rules for taxing multinational companies and also for protecting nation states across the world from the predatory and race to the bottom tactics of the OECD tax havens. But, you know, realistically, we've got to accept the very hard political fact that the prominent OECD member states, including Britain and the United States, both of which are major tax havens and protectors of tax havens, these states can exert powerful blocking measures within the United Nations political processes. So this might be a project that is best handled step by step. And a first step would be to elevate the existing United Nations Committee of Experts on International Tax Matters, which has no political status, by the way, to an intergovernmental body with political status. And this can be accompanied by a UN tax convention along the lines suggested by that high-level FACTI panel you mentioned. Now, I know from my own experience of working with the civil society group called the Friends of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, and I've been involved with that group over 15 years now, these conventions can take a really long time to draft and steer through the United Nations processes. And sometimes the initial conventions are weak, and they will require strengthening, but I think we just have to accept that's the case. What's needed more than anything else is to have a global counterweight to the rules set by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Now, whilst the OECD rules don't have legal status in their own right, they are typically adopted into the tax laws of member states and states across the rest of the world, and they become a reference point which courts and tribunals will use when they're assessing the legality or otherwise of a tax avoidance scheme. So a UN tax convention could become a really powerful mechanism and a reference point for the whole process of reshaping tax rules to make them fit for the 21st century and for the needs of all countries, not just OECD member states.
Yeah, and perhaps with the new administration, the Biden administration, there may be more support for some meaningful activity on tax rules, global tax rules, and perhaps even more support for a UN involvement in that. And they've just announced a 21% minimum corporate tax rate proposal, so that's interesting.
And alongside that, of course, the US, I'm very excited about this, if I'm honest, they're also talking about completely rebooting the Internal Revenue Service, massively refunding it to make it an effective body. So that in itself is exciting. But Joe Biden has spoken very publicly and for a long time about the United States re-engaging internationally, and there's no better place for him to demonstrate that kind of leadership role and engagement with the rest of the world than in the area of taxation and getting this one sorted. It has caused so many problems across the world now. It would be really good to see a Biden administration take a leadership role in this area.
Yes, it would. And speaking of the power of blocs and nations, let's look at the European Union. There is some movement there to do something about the EU's laughable list of non-cooperative jurisdictions. Their list, as we've said many times on the TaxCast, all the more ridiculous because EU member states themselves aren't included on that list when many of them are, you know, major offenders. And then you get sort of crazinesses like the removal of the Cayman Islands from the EU list, which is crazy. We know it absolutely belongs right up there along with a lot of other jurisdictions responsible for stripping other nations of tax revenue. So the EU.
Yeah, well, long sigh. This isn't the first time, and it certainly won't be the last time that you and I reflect on the absurdity of this European Union listing of so-called non-cooperative jurisdictions. Of course, we call non-cooperative jurisdictions tax havens, but they don't like that term. Now, the European Union list published in February 2021 includes 12 jurisdictions, almost all small islands, most of them located in the Caribbean, the Pacific, or the Indian Ocean. This list, which is prepared by the Code of Conduct Group on Business Taxation, and they do this work on behalf of the European Council, that begs an interesting question. Why isn't the United States of America listed? It has a massive offshore financial services sector. The US is ranked number 25 on the Tax Justice Network Corporate Tax Haven Index, and the US still hasn't signed up to the Global Common Reporting Standard for Tax Information Exchange, and yet somehow it avoids being listed by the European Union. So I think we can all recognize that the EU's listing process is ridiculous. If we look at the 12 jurisdictions listed in February 2021, it includes places like Samoa, Fiji, Dominica, and Guam. Now these 12 jurisdictions, between them, are responsible for less than 2% of the global corporate tax abuse risk. And what makes the European Union listing all the more outrageous is if you tally up the global corporate tax abuse risks arising just from European Union member states, that is Ireland, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and so on, you can see they are responsible between them for 38% of that global risk identified by the Tax Justice Network Corporate Tax Haven Index. Politically, I think this is very damaging to the European Union, and it sends a really strong signal to the rest of the world that the European Union is quite prepared to turn a blind eye to corrupt financial practices and to the ways in which powerful corporations harm local economies and harm democracy.
Yes, indeed. And just to add, the United States is number 2 in the Financial Secrecy Index, so yeah, they've got a lot of work to do. And yeah, I mean, the European Union needn't look no further, really. If you ask me, we've got already the Financial Secrecy Index and the Corporate Tax Haven Index, which thoroughly and non-politically looks at the evidence and assesses countries. I mean, you know, the work is all there for them to use if they are serious.
Well, let's hope the European Union picks up the phone to the Tax Justice Network and asks us if they can formally adopt the Corporate Tax Haven Index and the Financial Secrecy Index as a key part, if not the key part, of their listing process. The phone lines are open now.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Much of the world is run on the basis of economic theories that have become accepted truths of our era, but they actually have very little evidence to back them up. In fact, they're better described as faith-based beliefs. This month, I'm talking to finance journalist and author Tom Bergin about his book, Free Lunch Thinking, How Economics Ruins the Economy. In his book, he investigates the evidence for a series of economic theories, things like the notorious Laffer curve. So, do lower taxes really aid growth? He looks at things like the hire and fire debate. Does job security make us lazy? Does a minimum wage really lead to lost jobs? Are taxes on business damaging? Does regulation harm business? Things like that. And this book is great for anyone who wants to fully get why some of these beliefs are nonsense. Yet they endure. They're still central to policymaking around the world. We need to break these blind, faith-based beliefs and change the narrative. So it was great to talk to Tom, who's put these theories in the dock. And it's not just theories he puts in the dock. Here's Tom Bergen.
One of the jobs of an investigative reporter is to be shouted at and threatened by rich and powerful people. The particular one involving Donald Trump was whereby I was doing a story about him when he was running, he was a candidate for the presidency. And one of the main kind of selling points that he's offering the American public was that I could fix America's finances and improve the economy because I'm a great businessman and I've done this in my own business. And I started to look at the area where he had invested most of his money really over the previous 20 years, which was in the golf space. And I calculated, based on his own statements, he'd invested over $1 billion in golf assets and associated assets, which were worth about half that. So when I presented that evidence to him, he wasn't very happy. And we spent about 20 minutes, half an hour on the phone in rather robust discussion. But at the we also got around to talking about the economy and broader issues, during which he shared with me his base in supply-side economics and his general thinking that he could raise revenues and he could improve the balance by cutting tax. Well, later he became clear with the magic ingredients of tax cuts, which is essentially Lafferism, Laffer curve that Donald Trump was campaigning on. It's something that I tackle in quite detail in the book.
Yeah, and it's such a good place to start with somebody like Donald Trump, because there's so much kind of buzz around him as a person, and it's all about sort of presentation rather than substance, right? So in that same way, your book's all about economic theories, which have little to no basis in any evidence, but it doesn't stop people like Donald Trump using that to prop up how he might like the world to work, or at least how he might like us to believe that the world works. So, I mean, in the UK, not wanting to focus too much on the UK, but we just had the most saddening budget we've had for a quite long time, which seems to be based blatantly on a belief in trickle-down economics. And I just wonder what you think about whether politicians actually know that these economic theories are bullshit, or whether they actually do believe in them. And I mean, I'm not really sure which is worse, actually, ignorance or cynical deployment of myths that are politically useful for them and keep their donors happy. I mean, what do you think?
It's an interesting question. I think that, you know, if you look at Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who, you know, really pillars of the Republican establishment for much of the past half century, really, they talked about seeing the Laffer curve for the first time and that being a major moment in their education and economics. I remember David Gawke, the former tax minister in the UK, asking him about why he was cutting corporate taxes so robustly. And he said, you know, this was informed by the economic theory presented by the OECD and others, which showed that essentially the corporation tax was a bad tax and stunted growth. So there's definitely, I think, an influence there, a reliance on theory. It's true, obviously, some of these people can also be attracted to what's intuitive to them. I mean, in the case of Cheney, we certainly saw that as vice president. When it came to intelligence matters, he tended to have a little bit of a leaning towards information that he liked the sound of. But I think also we can see where the theory's influence is also evidence when we see people change their minds.
Yeah, and you talk about one such person who seems really unlikely person to change his mind after having spent a career advancing really damaging faith-based economic theories. You talk in the book about the former member of the Chicago School of Economics, Paul Romer, who you met, who did change his mind. And he said the Chicago School was basically a libertarian anti-government project, not a scientific endeavor.
Absolutely. That was a really, you know, interesting meeting. I've spoken to Paul Romer a few times, and his journey is a really interesting one. And he has made himself something of a pariah among the economic establishment in the United States by calling out by name specific very senior economists, Nobel Prize winners, and saying that basically they are dishonest. And he says that these people are advancing ideas not based in fact, it's totally ideology, and when they produce evidence using fancy maths to defend it, usually that maths is there intended to hide things rather than to reveal a complex truth. And, you know, I think the fact that people do sometimes change their mind is massively interesting. Unfortunately, it's quite rare. And, you know, one of the points that I discussed with Paul Rummer was the way that there's, unfortunately, within the economics community, there's a perverse incentive there that economists, it's in their interest to advance the view of the world as being a mechanism determined by price relationships. Because if we all accept that's how the world works, then the people we need to go to provide the answers to the problems of the world are economists. This is just a wonderful position to be in for any profession, to be the people who, you know, the wise people of the world or the world leaders say, these are the people with the answers. So unfortunately, I think that the economists are faced with that incentive to advance ideas which are not correct, but which afford them influence. Hopefully, economists can learn to be humble, to accept perhaps a less influential role. If they do, I think they might make a much more valuable contribution to the world.
Right, and you called your book Free Lunch Thinking, How Economics Ruins the Economy. It's a great title. Why did you call it that?
I'm glad you like it. The main title is a play on an old saying that was popularized by conservative economist Milton Friedman. He would say there's no such thing as a free lunch. And I think that was really intended as a sort of right-wing retort to liberals who argued that there should be regulation on companies and taxation on the affluent to, you know, improve society. Now, I'm one of those who thinks that Milton Friedman was an ideologue, more that than a social scientist. If you really follow the logic of people like Friedman to its conclusion, what you find out is that people who say, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch in a very real politic kind of world or, you know, hard fact truth position, to say actually they become the ones who are arguing for a free lunch. And so specifically, you know, we'll see situations where people end up arguing, you know, if you cut taxes, you can raise revenue. I mean, there's a free lunch. Isn't that wonderful? Or you can remove social protections like worker safety rules without making people less safe, and also in the meantime, make everyone richer. Here we go, free lunch.
And how about the second part of the title, How Economics Ruins the Economy?
With respect to how economics ruins the economy, I think that economic theory and the markets determine the world is a belief which has caused a lot of damage, and not just social damage in terms of inequality, but also made us poorer. You know, what we see is that some ideas like, you know, trying to, you know, raise tax revenue by cutting taxes actually can be damaging to the economy. So what I say in the book is I look through a number of policies which have been advanced and defended as a way to grow the economy, make it grow more quickly, and show that it hasn't. So what we're seeing are lost opportunities. So it's damaging the economy. In terms of specific people, of course, the damage can be much worse. If you look at something like the minimum wage, economists argued for decades that the minimum wage is a bad idea and that it would cost jobs among the least well-off. They argue worse that there was lots of evidence to prove that. There was no evidence to prove that, and it hasn't been the case. It's been tested again and again in different countries. You know, this means that people were denied wage increases, that the economy could have very effectively paid them, and their life has been significantly disadvantaged. There are lots of other cases for this. So I think that it has caused a lot of damage that economists should answer for.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so important to make this point, but it actually harms the economy as well. It's not just people. And, you know, this double standard in terms of the very wealthy and corporations perfectly happy to take all sorts of state subsidies, but not being okay about, you know, the minimum wage or expecting the state to cover food stamps and things like this when people can't afford to buy enough food for their families. You know, the double standard thing is just so fascinating. I wanted to ask you about how the field of economics is so dominated by men historically, that's very slowly changing. You know, you've been a finance journalist for a long time. You've seen how the mainstream media commentators on business and finance are also very male-dominated. And I don't want to push this too far, but, you know, to what extent do you think popular ideas about business that are propagated in the mainstream media are kind of testosterone-fueled?
I think the depiction of the business world that you describe, I think it's true that it is described in testosterone-fueled ways. It's described, the business world, as a battle, you know, competing forces. And this, you know, lends itself to the reporting of heroic figures who are being successful. And I think, you know, there is a strong case, particularly in the retail end of the media, where people are trying to sell business news stories to a broader audience, that there might be a case that that can help, you know, enliven it. But I think it is something that's very much informed by economic theory. And if you look at the general economic view of the world, which is that it's a series of markets where you have buyers and sellers constantly vying against one another, as you say, that's quite a testosterone-fueled kind of environment and way to perceive the world. That there's an ongoing battle for control and power between different sides, and that process leads to value creation in itself, that people are forced to strive to compete in a more competitive way. Is that influenced by men, the fact that economics has always been a male-driven thing? I mean, I guess we should be surprised if it's not. That's the way that boys are taught to see the world, as competing on the, you know, playing fields or whatever. Now, I don't think that it's a particularly accurate view or informative view of the wealth generation process. I think it totally overlooks the benefits and the gains from collaboration and cooperation. But the big businesses who are interested in value creation know the way to make more money is to get their workers to cooperate together in a more effective way. So I think, you know, that's something that's not depicted well within the theoretical framework of economics, which then informs the way we perceive business. So yes, I think that the kind of cliched, easy, lazy view of the way that business and the economy works is inaccurate, and I hope there is enough evidence coming through at the moment to show that that sort of rather old style view is not one that we can really make decisions based on.
I wanted to ask you about those who are most responsible for some of these economic myths and how they actually live their lives. I always find this so fascinating. It tells you everything about the nature of their connection to the rest of the world and to people in the country they live in, you know. And you describe in the book going to Arthur Laffer's house, Arthur Laffer being the main architect of the Laffer curve, you know, the theory that cutting taxes will lead to growth. And so when you visited him, you talk about how he chose a particular state to live in the US because of the tax benefits there. And he says from the savings he got from these tax benefits, he bought his entire house. And, you know, it sounds like a lot like a used car salesman. But, I mean, what impressions did you have of this man whose work has really shaped bad economic decisions for decades that have been hurting so many people?
Arthur Laffer, at a personal level, is very gregarious. And I think that's probably one of the things that has helped him be influential. He's someone who's advised Democrats as well as Republicans. He, you know, when you visit his house, he has pictures of him with, you know, the Kennedys and all kinds of people from, you know, both sides of the aisle. And one of the things, points I make in the book is that he's very good at marketing, and those personal skills actually, you know, the ability, you know, to quick with an anecdote and a joke and able to paint a picture quite nicely. That's really one of the things that has helped advance supply side economics and the Laffer curve, something that really doesn't have any data, but, you know, there's lots of good stories there to back it up. So there's quite strong, I would say, personal skills. I'm a journalist, I'm not a priest, so it's not my job to say if someone being a tax exile is, you know, morally repugnant. I think, you know, people make their own decision on it. I would say that, you know, mathematically speaking, there is a consequence to that, you know, that everybody can't decide to work in one country and pay their taxes on the moon, you know, where tax rates are zero. You know, no idea of social responsibility.
Yeah, it's a sad way to live, actually, to have this disconnect from the rest of society.
It can be quite a sort of contentious view of their fellow man, particularly their fellow man who has not been as financially successful as they are, and the natural human tendency to believe that everything good that comes into their lives is their own just desserts.
And we know that some of the super rich, you know, are not necessarily living happy lives. and Lasser is still so important. You know, he was an advisor to Trump before and during his presidency, who then went on and made the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act the centre of his economic policy. He gave Lasser the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the US's highest civilian honour. I mean, it's incredible how far a good story and the gift of the gab will get somebody.
Absolutely. It's all the way you tell them. The supply side economics kind of really leveraged off a few stories that just really captured people's imagination. The value of good stories, they really can have an outsized impact on how people accept ideas. Hopefully, I think when you show people that the ideas that they have aren't supported in the way that they think they are, that evidence is not there. Just to call out and say the emperor has no clothes, I hope, is a valuable activity.
Valuable indeed. Thanks, Tom. Tom Bergin's book, Free Lunch Thinking, How Economics Ruins the Economy, is published by Penguin. You can get the details in the show notes. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.